This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with David Haldorf on the 28th of March 2001 at approximately 9:20 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Haldorf is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Sir, why don't you go ahead and begin by briefly discussing your early life, in particular when and where you were born and where you grew up.
Born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Still live here on the north side of the city. Went to public schools, public high school. Went into the service, and when I came out of the service, continued education with the Milwaukee Area Technical College. Worked for Outboard Marine Corporation for 33 years and retired June 30th of 1998. Also run a home inspection company that I started and used my my schooling that I had taken through going back to the high school.
Okay. Now, when did you graduate from high school?
June of 1965, Custer High School.
Okay. And between 1965 and 1967, when you joined the Army, you were in that going to additional training school.
What happened there is local companies. The high school that I went to was kind of like a technical high school. There was one of the few in the city that that had either trade classes or business classes. I took architectural drafting and construction shop courses through the last 3 years of high school. And businesses would come into the school and take applications. So right out of high school, I got a job as an architectural draftsman working for August Wolf Company. And I stayed there for maybe about a year. Then I left there and went to a small manufacturing company, worked there for a short amount of time, and then went to Outboard Marine Corporation.
All right. And what led you to go into the military in August of 1967?
I was drafted, and after I was drafted, I spoke to a few people in the area. Everybody was getting drafted. Basically, I had a good friend that was also looking into the service, and he enlisted before he was drafted, and he recommended, since I was living in a one-parent family and couldn't afford college, that I enlist for the extra year and then go to school after the service on the GI Bill, which I did.
Okay. What led you to the Army versus the other services?
Probably the biggest factor was the Army was 3 years. If I would have gone into the Navy, Air Force, that's 4 years. Not sure about the Marines. Since I did come from a one-parent family, I figured the 3 years would be long enough to be away from my my mother, who was ill with cancer.
Okay. When you were going to school, was there ROTC, junior ROTC, or anything like that available to you? Or?
Are you talking about before the service?
Right. Yeah. In your high school. Was a junior
I don't artist. Believe so. If there was, I probably wasn't interested. I don't remember anything offered there as far as military classes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you? Was there anything about the military that you were drawn to in terms of your exposure to popular culture, movies, and things like that?
Not really. I think the basic idea was. I was going to be drafted anyway, take the extra year, go for the education, kind of figuring if I had a better MOS, military occupation specialty, that I wouldn't be a grunt, walking around with a rifle in the jungle. Mm-hmm. And basically that did turn out to be that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so in August of 1967, when you joined the Army, you had already taken the battery of tests, And did you already know at that point that you were going to become a mechanic, a vehicle track
yes,
mechanic?
And I don't remember going to a recruiting station, but I'm sure that I must have done that. They basically show you the areas that you can get involved with. Because of the fact that that I had been involved with automobiles, racing, hot rods, that type of thing, I figured that I didn't realize that that they may have had architects in the Army. So I just I decided to go into the field of mechanics, and then I was offered being offered one school, I was offered two. And in that respect, I went through basic training, which is the normal 8, 12 weeks or whatever it was, followed by two AITs, one for, I guess they call it general wheel mechanics, and then the other one I took in Fort Knox, Kentucky, which was a track mechanic school.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and talk about what you understood in terms of the Vietnam War. From the time you graduated, which when you graduated in June 65, we were at war, although not declared, and then 2 years. You know, did you keep up with it in the news? Did you know kind of what was going on?
I don't believe I knew a whole lot of what was going on there, why, the politics of the war.
Mm-hmm.
I lived next door to a large family. One of the older boys was Green Beret, and he had come home a few times. I believe he went over in around 1964 or 65. He didn't speak too much of it. I don't remember seeing a whole lot on TV at the time before I went in. I basically felt that that I was going to have to go over there, try to get a job that's away from most of the action, and put in my time and get out of the service.
Okay. Did you have any relatives that had served in previous wars, World War II, Korea?
I was adopted when I was 15 months old, so I did not find my natural parents until about 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
So that left me as an only child, an adopted family, and then those folks had adopted me, divorced when I was 7.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have much knowledge of my adopted parents, their background as far as any war service. I do know that my natural mother's brother was in World War II and had spent quite a bit of time at Wood Veterans Administration Hospital here in the Milwaukee area,
mm-hmm.
In which he had some problems, but I don't know the details.
Okay. Well, what did you know in terms of, you know, what was happening in Vietnam? Why was the United States involved, you know, when you enlisted in 1967?
I didn't have a clue. I had no idea why we were over there.
Okay.
I didn't know the history of Vietnam, you know, as I do now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the involvement with the French going back into the 50s, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew is that we were there, supposedly fighting communism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that I got that information from word from the other high school students and whatever little we could catch on the TV.
Okay. So when you went into the Army, into basic training, let's see, you did your basic training at Fort Campbell.
Correct.
Why don't you go ahead and discuss, describe your first experiences, your introduction to the Army and what basic training was like?
Well, the first introduction was, if I remember right, I think we took a train from the Milwaukee recruiting area where we had, I think we took a kind of a physical there before we went, although we took a physical to be, you know, able to go into the service, I think we took a physical there again, I believe we were put on a train and went down to the Chicago area, and then flew into Fort Campbell, Kentucky, put in these big green buses, and I think we went into like a general area where we were issued a lot of green clothes and a big duffel bag, shoved all that stuff in there, went and got a military haircut, and dropped off in front of a big building that we were going to be staying in. And from then on, it was yes, sir, no, sir, and getting straightened out into the building, into the living area, making beds, putting our stuff away, being told how to fold socks, that type of thing. And then we basically started initiating classes. Classes all the way through on the military code of conduct. In between classes, a lot of physical training, exercising, running. I believe that there was a, we did have some type of, like, contest between other battalions to see who could get the most points as far as physical, being physically fit. I think that lasted for, like, at least 3 weeks before we were able to go into an on-post bar to have some 3-2 beer. After that, we were allowed, I think another week later, or maybe another 2 weeks later, we were allowed a weekend or a one-day pass to go into town. Although, when we did go into town, there were signs off of Main Street that the military wasn't allowed into the other section of town. And then we had rifle training. See how well you could shoot a rifle. Gas mask training. That's an incident that everybody I think remembers real well. Go into a contained area, put a gas mask on, and they drop a pellet into some water, and then the gas would come up, and then they tell you to take off your gas mask and then put it on and clear it. And then some of the guys were tearing, they're walking from the tear gas, that type of thing. The gas would get into your clothes, so for the rest of the day when you sat in classes, you were falling asleep. And then you basically graduated after about 8 or 9 weeks. A lot of physical activity, run 2 miles before every meal, great, a lot of food, ate like a horse, gained weight, felt good. And that was the end of the basic training. We did have some time there. We could go to there were shows on post, movie theater, cafe, music room, library. So there were some things that you could do after about the fourth or fifth week. Mm-hmm. Although before that, they kept you pretty busy.
Okay. What was the most challenging aspect for you?
In basic training?
Mm-hmm.
That would be the physical aspect. I was tall and not real muscular. Didn't have any problems with the running aspect, but with the... they had these ladders that you had to do like 5 or 6 lengths of ladders before every meal, and then the push-ups and all that type of thing. Took me a while to get used to that. Towards the end, I didn't have any problem with it.
Okay. Were there any particular incidents you recall from your basic training? You know, more specific things.
There was like a food wagon that would come around once in a while, and you could get a sweet roll, which was much different than the rest of the food that they were feeding you. So quite a few of the guys looked forward to doing that. Policing up the area for cigarette butts, that was like an everyday thing. Waxing the barracks floor with paste wax, try to get it, make it look like wax when these buildings were like ancient. Doing the cleaning up in the bathroom, going to the bathroom with no partitions in between them was a little bit different than the normal living. Had a Sergeant Peoples, I forget what they called him, but he was a sergeant that basically told you what to do all the time. He was a little guy. And he always, when information, he always kept telling me to keep my feet together, mm-hmm. because I have, like, big feet there, like duck feet, that stick out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I didn't always keep my feet exactly together. Mm-hmm. Taking the rifle, we had to score that. Because of the fact that I had glasses, I didn't do as well as I wanted to. It was raining. It had rain on the glasses. I wanted to do better, but they wouldn't let me. And for some reason, I wanted to do well in that. Mm-hmm. Went into Elizabethtown, I believe it was. No, it wasn't Elizabethtown. It was a town that was out of Fort Campbell. With that one day pass, where we realized that that the signs were up in the town where they didn't want us into the suburban area, we did go in there with about four or five men. One of them was black. When we asked for some beer, the owner of the place or the bartender told us that he wouldn't serve the black guy that was with us, which was the first time that I ever ran into anything that racial. Although we did have some, right before I went into the service, we had some riots here in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. That's about it.
Well, what was the racial and ethnic makeup of your platoon, your basic training platoon?
I would say maybe 3 to 5% African American. Mm-hmm. Small amount, it seemed. Mm-hmm.
Any other particular groups that stand out? You know, Hispanics or Chicanos?
No.
Okay. And how did you guys respond to that? How did that soldier respond to this blatant discrimination?
I don't really remember what the soldier did, but the rest of us told the guy to take a hike and we left without purchasing anything. And I don't remember where we went after that. If we went into another bar, or what we did. But I do remember that incident real plainly.
Do you remember any other racial tensions or racial incidents while you were going through basic training?
None.
Okay. How did your drill instructors enforce discipline?
Physical therapy, or not therapy, but physical, you know, do some push-ups, run a mile, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Might have got some extra guard duty.
Okay.
You know, get up at 1 o'clock in the morning and stand guard for 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Or maybe some policing of the grounds, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Nothing, no physical contact.
And was there anybody injured or killed in your basic training group?
No, I don't believe so. Okay. I don't. Other than even like myself, you know, turn an ankle or something, mm-hmm. You know, while you're running or during training, but nothing, no big injuries.
Okay. Well, you went from your basic training to your AIT, initial AIT, which was at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and that was in let's see. When was that? October of 68, is that correct? October of 60.
I went in August of 67.
Right,
so. Figure on 8 to 12, 3 months.
Mm-hmm. For basic.
I can't remember if I had a little leave in there. I don't believe so.
Mm-hmm.
It and then it followed right after the basic training.
Okay. So you were, so you went to Fort Huachuca from about October to December of 67.
That sounds right.
Why don't you go ahead and describe that transition? You know, how different was AIT from basic training and just the general types
of experiences? The areas that we slept in, the buildings that we slept in, were almost the same. It was sort of like, you know, older buildings, no privacy, bunk beds, one up and one down, and a bunch of guys in like a one room building with a shower in the front of the place. No grass around. Instead of mowing lawns down there, they raked sand. It was hot. We didn't have summer khakis. We had winter khakis that we were issued in the Fort Campbell area, so that didn't help. We did have to do some parade type things, get dressed up in those khakis and perform some parades out in this field for some generals or whoever. We had the jail across the street from us, so you could see some of these guys walking around in jail once in a while. We had the cook school next to us, or fairly close to us, so they kind of like used some of the stuff that they made on us to see if we liked it. The schooling was good. They had good classes, good instructors. We didn't pull as much extra duty. There was more to do in our time off. There was a bowling alley there. I think there was an EM club, cafeteria. We could go in. There was Sierra Vista town right. I think it was abutted to the fort, although it was basically, I think they had a bowling alley, they might have had a bar or two, and the rest of it was all trailer houses. We called it Sorry Vista. Got to be like 115, 120 sometimes. At night it went down to like 70 degrees and 70, 75, and it felt cold. But much better than basic.
Just out of curiosity, you mentioned the prison near
yeah.
you. During basic or during your AITs, did anybody lose it and have to be punished more sternly than just through push-ups and sit-ups?
I don't remember anybody from our unit or from the classes that I was in.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Now, the your AIT training, your initial training.
That was the first AIT training.
Right, at Fort Huachuca. What
right.
was... Now, this training was specifically in what?
That was in what they call either light or general wheel vehicle training. Gas engines for the smaller vehicles, Jeeps, 3/4-ton trucks, 5-ton trucks, gas and diesel engines.
And were you trained? At what level of maintenance were you trained? All the way down, breaking it, the whole vehicle down? Or?
No, that would. No, this was. We wouldn't rebuild an engine. We wouldn't rebuild a transmission. We might rebuild a rear end. Basically, it was tune-ups, replacement parts, kind of like the same type of thing you might do in your garage for your own car. But if you would have had you know, if you needed more detailed work, you'd send it into someplace else. I think the higher type education would be called battalion maintenance, where they might tear an engine down and rebuild it.
Okay. And what was the most challenging part of this training for you?
There wasn't really anything that was real challenging in that. I got great grades. They even asked me to be an instructor in that area. about the only thing that I didn't care for was the fact that I was quite a few miles away from home. My mother was sick. Didn't like the heat. I wasn't used to seeing sand, flat, no air, you know, no green, no trees, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just didn't care for the area.
Okay. Now, was there anything in particular from that school that, you know, they didn't discuss, go over with regard to just the wheeled vehicles that you wish later on when you were in Vietnam and if you did work on wheeled vehicles that you wish they had talked about?
They basically covered just about everything that that we needed to do overseas as far as those vehicles concerned. At that time, you know, they didn't have the computerized, engines. So if you did have electrical problems, they could have maybe gone a little bit more into electrical, but they still gave us the ability to check electrical. The problem was is that we didn't have the electrical equipment in Vietnam, in our battery anyway, to do that type of checking, to follow up on electrical shorts and open wires and that type of thing.
Okay. Well, during the basic training or your first DIT, how many of the instructors were Vietnam veterans?
Well, I know that in basic, I know that there was one of the sergeants, an airborne sergeant, that was a Vietnam vet.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the rest of them were or not. I don't remember. I don't remember seeing a lot of badges or anything on their uniforms. And even if I did, I probably wouldn't have been able to at that time to recognize the fact that it meant that they were a Vietnam vet.
Mm-hmm. How about for your second AIT, Fort Knox?
You mean as far as the
Vietnam veterans? Yes.
I think our second AIT was more civilian instructors than Army instructors.
Okay. During your training at either AIT or in basic training, did they talk much about Vietnam?
They being who, the instructors?
Yes, sir.
No, I didn't. I didn't hear a whole lot. Most of the discussion on Vietnam came from within the group that was being trained,
mm-hmm.
as to I wonder if we're going to go, I wonder if we're going to come back, that type of thing.
But you didn't receive any kind of training about Vietnam.
I don't remember. There is what they call a jungle school that. That's been mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if I went to that in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I know that they had one in Vietnam, but I don't remember going to it in Vietnam. And it was short. It was like a one-day little area, if I remember right, it sort of looked like a small village or a hamlet, and then they kind of showed you where some booby traps might be or that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Well, so when you received your orders for your second AIT, did you know already that you were going to be going to that school, which was,
yes.
Again, this is Army
yes,
School.
Yes, that was arranged when I signed up for the extra year.
Okay. So first wheeled vehicle and then tracked vehicle.
Correct.
Okay. And then you went, let's see, I guess you left in December of 67 and went to Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Right. I think I left about the middle of December.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I had a 2-week furlough or whatever you want to call it, and then I was supposed to report on New Year's Day in Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Okay. What was the training like at Fort Knox?
It was a little bit different than the first training. Much nicer area, nicer buildings. I was what they called like a little platoon leader or something, or kind of like interpreted or kind of passed on orders to some of the rest of the guys. The housing was sort of the same, but for three or four of us guys that were sort of like the group leaders within the class, you got a separate little room with four bunks in it. No more KP, no more cleaning up, no more. I don't remember being in a parade in Fort Knox. It was basically all school. The area where the mess hall that we ate in was all civilian run. There was nobody, no military in there, and we didn't have to serve or we didn't have to pull KP. They had people there that were civilians that did that for us. Training was I feel better than Fort Huachuca. The buildings and equipment that they used were a little bit better. The instructors, I think, were a little bit better. The fort was nicer. There was more to do at the fort. You had more free time. Basically, the military personnel that was in charge of that building and would take us to classes, and that was not quite the same as basic training. In that, you know, the shouting of orders and that type of thing ceased. It was more like going to a college.
Okay. What was the most challenging part of that training for you?
I think the hardest part of that training was the fact that it was January in Kentucky. It was cold, colder than what I thought it would have been coming from Wisconsin. We did have some field, what they called field mobility training, as far as tank or track vehicle training is. If you had a vehicle that needed to be recovered, we would go out in the field in the middle of winter, and we'd have to go through. We'd drive tanks through the snow. I remember one time we mistaken for what we thought was earth, not realizing that it was too flat and it was a pond that we went through, and a big piece of ice came up and almost hit the driver. Because he had his hatch open. That was about the most challenging as far as that class or that school.
Okay. And to what level of maintenance were you trained?
That would be basically the same as the first school. We might pull an engine out of tanks. To replace, either replace the engine. It was easier to replace a starter on a tank by removing the engine than trying to get down into that area to remove it. We had instruction on large, real large gas and was gas engines, which they actually weren't using anymore. When we got to Vietnam, they were all diesel. So that training kind of like really didn't help us as far as the gas engines went. Taught to how to replace tracks and how to replace the torsion bars. There's large torsion bars under the that control the wheels and pressure on the wheels because of it being so heavy. We had a little bit more of electrical training, not as much as I figured that there should be. And not enough turret, you know, the tanks have turrets on them, not enough turret training. But turret mechanic was another MOS, so that was another specialty.
Okay. Now, the training, the vehicles you were trained on at Fort Knox, did these include tanks, self-propelled artillery, both, or just one or the other?
The only Fort Knox was an armor fort. There was no artillery to speak of that I seen there. But the unit that I was in Vietnam basically was the same body. It had the only difference was that instead of being a howitzer that was towed behind a 5-ton or a 10-ton truck, it was mounted on a track vehicle. And I'm assuming that's why, as a track mechanic, I was put into an 8-inch self-propelled howitzer unit.
Okay. Now, did the tanks that you worked on at Fort Bragg, did they have any kind of...
It's not Fort Bragg, it was Fort...
I mean, I'm sorry, at Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Right.
Yeah, the tanks that you worked on there, what were they? What nomenclature?
If I'm not mistaken, they were, I think they were the M45. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. They may have had one M60 tank in there, but I believe they were using older tanks for instruction. Which actually, if I would have went into an armor unit, it would have made a difference.
Okay.
But since I went into an artillery outfit, I basically got the general idea.
Mm-hmm. And so when you went to Vietnam, the power plant, the transmission, the chassis, whatever, everything on those self-propelled artillery vehicles that you worked on, they were the same as the M45s or different?
Well, obviously they were updated, but it was General Motors diesels that were in the artillery pieces in Vietnam. The transmissions were basically General Motors. I can't remember exactly the name of the company that actually made them, but they were Cadillac used the. Used that technology in their first 1970 Eldorados with the front-wheel drive and with the planetary gears and that type of thing used for front-wheel drive. So it was basically the same as the tanks, except the fact that the one engine that they were training us on was an old engine, old gasoline engine. We didn't have the only gas engine that we had over there was in our Jeeps and 3/4-ton trucks. Everything else was diesel.
Okay. And the training on the tanks. No accidents. No problems.
Not as far as for me. I had a good buddy, Lonnie Sulfur, that lost the end of one of his fingers because he didn't remove his hand from an area after trying to release a torsion rod, and it took that off, and he had to go to the post hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That was I think the worst accident that I remember.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I don't know if you would work on a part of the vehicle that would be similar to this, but the vehicles, the tanks that you worked on at Fort Knox, and then the self-propelled artillery track vehicles you worked on in Vietnam, did either of those have the fire on the move stabilization systems?
No.
So basically, you had.
You're talking about like the newer tanks now where you see on TV where they're cruising along at 40 miles an hour and they're shooting at the same time.
Right. Yeah,
no,
being able to fire on the move. Accurately.
No, we didn't have that.
Okay.
I'm assuming one of the reasons is the fact that the guns that we had over there were so big and powerful that when the artillery people in the gun section set up our guns, they had a big spade in the back that they had to dig into the ground in order to keep them in place. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like the And they didn't traverse that far. You know, you basically had to have that spade behind you in order to shoot in one direction. You couldn't turn that turret sideways and shoot with the track vehicle being opposite of the direction of the gun tube. It would roll the vehicle right over.
Okay. So just the physical limitations, the physics of it, meant that the vehicle had to be stationary, had to be facing in the direction you're firing the gun.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else you wanted to discuss with regard to your training before you went to Vietnam?
About the only, and I think I mentioned that in the typewritten area, mm-hmm. was the fact that that I thought the training wasn't quite up to what we needed to know in Vietnam. One of the reasons being that a lot of guys were transferred in and out. We only served 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you learned the ropes, it was almost time to go home.
Mm-hmm.
So it was constant. It was a constant training over there also.
Mm-hmm.
If a turret mechanic that was trained higher in the electrics or hydraulics area transferred out of the unit, and you didn't get a guy to replace him right away, you were told to go fix that. So that was a learning situation there. You basically had to try and figure out what was wrong, and then you learned that as a process as you went through this year.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you went home, you could probably fix anything on the gun. But then you were going home, so it didn't do any good.
Well, it's kind of jumping ahead, but since you brought up the subject, knowing that you if the system had been different, you would have been staying longer. Do you think they should have had a longer service term for Vietnam soldiers serving in Vietnam?
Well, they did have that area or option of extending.
Right, option should have been compulsory. Should have been a compulsory aspect of service. If you go to Vietnam, you serve 2 years.
I don't think so. In Vietnam. I think if they wanted to, to extend anything, they should have extended the training in the States and gave you your 1 year over there. A year in Vietnam is plenty.
Mm-hmm. But cover more in training, so
right.
The learning curve in Vietnam was less.
Meaning what? I'm not sure. I don't know.
In other words, you train more here in the United States so that when you do get to Vietnam, the learning curve and the training curve, that is, you don't have to be trained or
correct
or taught as much when you finally do get on the ground.
Right.
Hmm. Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and discuss your transition to Vietnam then.
Okay.
When did you receive your orders? You did volunteer to go to Vietnam. Is that correct?
No.
Oh, you did not volunteer to go to Vietnam?
No.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead?
I volunteered to go into the service for the extra year after I was drafted.
Right.
I didn't raise my hand and say, let me go.
Okay. Well, what did you think when you received orders?
Well, I basically figured that I was going to get them. And once I received them, I figured, okay, I'm going to be going. I'm going to have to do a year over there. I hope I come back. I was hoping that I would have the type of job that didn't put me as much in harm's way as I would as a grunt soldier. I don't remember what I thought when I received the notification that I was going to be in an artillery outfit. I guess I must have assumed that I was going to be in either like a maintenance or possibly an armor outfit, but I got the artillery outfit, so I guess I didn't really know what I really had in store as far as artillery.
Okay. How scared were you?
I was scared. I knew that there was a chance that I wouldn't come back.
Did you have correspondence with your family, with your mom, at this point? Were you writing back and forth to each other?
Are you talking about from my last AIT or Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. Both. Well, from basic through to your last AIT.
Not a whole lot of writing in basic training. A few letters. They kept it pretty busy in basic. When I got to Fort Huachuca, I did. I had correspondence via mail and telephone. Same with well, then I came home for 2 weeks, so I had, you know, I spent 2 weeks with my mother. Then I went to Fort Knox, and that was basically the same thing. Kept in contact via letters and telephone. And then I came home, and I believe I had another month, another 2 weeks mm-hmm. of the month that you normally got. And then I headed out for Vietnam, and when I was in Vietnam, it was letters only contact.
Okay. And what emotion did she express when she learned you're going to Vietnam? Anything in particular?
I would say average for a mother, mm-hmm. wondering if I was going to return.
Yeah. How much of a break after your second AIT did you have before you left?
I think it was about the same. If I remember right, I think we got like, I think it got like, I'm not sure if it was 2 weeks or if it was a month, a year that you got what they call leave of absence. Mm-hmm. But if I remember right, I thought I got 2 weeks in between the first AIT and the second, and then before I went to Vietnam, I think I had an additional 2 weeks.
So what did you, where did you leave from the United States? And go ahead and describe the trip over.
I flew from Milwaukee to Fort Lewis, Washington, mm-hmm. Landed in the, I guess they call it the SeaTac airport there. Once there, we didn't stay there too long. I think we were there long enough to receive jungle fatigues, you know, a few items like that. I don't think we were there any more than maybe 3 or 4 days. From there, we took a large jet. I believe we stopped in one of two places on the way there and one of two places on the way back. I think it was either... I think we stopped in Hong Kong on the way there, and then flew into Vietnam from that one from that first place we stopped. When we were coming into the area where we're landing in Cam Ranh Bay, one of the things I remember that it was really dark. Considering normal, we were flying at night. I landed at night. Compared to flying in the States, where you see homes that are lit up and all that type of thing, so a little more scared mm-hmm. When we landed. Once we landed, opened the when I reached the door to walk out and walk down onto the airport landing strip there. A lot of heat, a foul odor hit you, mm-hmm. and that's about all I remember until we spent about 3 or 4 days in Cam Ranh Bay area. I think they gave you a little bit more clothing. And then they shipped you to up to the area of your service battery of the unit that you were going to be in. Mm-hmm. Once you got to the service battery, I believe that is where they issued you your weapon. And that took me up to the up to getting into the service battery of the unit that I was in.
Mm-hmm. What were your first impressions of your unit?
Well, first of all, being in service battery is not like being in the in one of the other batteries. Mm-hmm. Our unit consisted of A, B, and C battery, which were batteries that were the gun batteries. Then we had a service battery, which was basically, it's called a service battery because they service the three gun batteries.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have, then you have what you call a headquarters battery,
mm-hmm.
Which is the administrative portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
Service battery was at the Phuket Air Force Base around Quinang.
Mm-hmm.
That area, you stayed in and pulled some detail until they figured out which battery that they needed you most in.
Mm-hmm.
You basically pulled detail while you were there. One of the details that I was put on was moving some large railroad ties. Three of us were moving that. One of them lost their grip. The railroad tie fell on one of my big toes.
Ooh.
So then I wasn't able to go to the gun battery, so I was pulling detail there in service battery as to my condition. And the condition was didn't enable me to do a whole lot of walking at first. I rode shotgun on a gasoline truck.
Mm-hmm.
I figured that was like close to like the worst job you could probably get
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first experience as far as the service battery went. On my first trip to A battery and at landing zone Pony, we were mortared while we were going there. Mortars landed behind the truck. I guess I realized what I got myself into at that point.
Now, what kind of briefings did you receive when you arrived? Any kind of, you know, just an in-country brief, telling you what you should and shouldn't do, things like that?
I don't remember what we received as far as coming into the service battery. I'm sure that somewhere along the line, either in Cameron Bay or service battery, they probably gave you a little pamphlet on what you should be doing and as far as... you know, who you can contact as far as local people go, how to conduct yourself, that type of thing. But I really don't remember getting that.
Okay. Do you remember being briefed on rules and regulations concerning interactions with Vietnamese people?
I don't remember getting that, but that would be like what I was just explaining.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that they had something like that.
Yeah. Okay. And you mentioned earlier being shotgun on that gas truck. To your knowledge, or did you ever hear of any gas trucks being targeted and hit?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't. I don't remember hearing, or I know I didn't see any that were hit.
Okay.
And I don't remember any anybody ever seeing, spreading the rumor or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what did you think? Or what were you told was the mission of your unit? You know, who were you supporting, and what were you trying to accomplish?
When I finally was sent to C battery, which was one of the gun batteries that was located in Bin K on Highway 19. I was advanced party with a first sergeant and another fella. The gun battery was in Bami Tuit, which was quite a distance away, and then they finally came back. I basically understood that my normal job was to keep everything running, keep as many vehicles running as possible, and we were there to support the infantry battalions that were in our area. We shot support for a couple of airborne outfits. The first cab, I think, was across the street from us. We set up with a Republic of Korea infantry 1st Tiger Division that also was located in part of them were located at LZ Diamond Head, where our first location was. And then while we were in that area, we also set up with a couple other locations that the Korean soldiers were with. So we supported the ROK soldiers up until the time from mid to late April up until I believe late June or early July when we moved to the Upper Highlands. And that's what I think that's what our objective was you know, when they needed us, we had to be ready and we had to give them artillery support.
Mm-hmm. When you before you got to C Battery, when you were in service, the service battery, and when you rode shotgun, did your unit come under any kind of contact with the enemy?
I don't remember having I don't remember being mortared or anything like that while we were at Phuket Air Force Base at that service battery location. The only contact I remember was on the road to A Battery at LZ Pony. After that, when we were at LZ Diamond Head in Bent K, I don't remember being shot at or getting mortared. It wasn't until we moved to Artillery Hill in Pleiku when I first experienced incoming.
Okay. Well, what was the morale of the unit like? And go ahead, and if you would discuss the morale in Service Battery first, and then the morale of C Battery when you arrived there.
I wasn't in Service Battery long enough to really discuss the morale of the people in Service Battery.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of figured it would be a little bit better than the gun batteries that would be out in the boonies. As far as C Battery goes, I think the morale was good. I don't remember any incidences that would lead me to believe any different. We did have times when we would get together in the mess hall or out on guard duty or whatever, and there were times there that we had some laughs, that type of thing. It was tough. Obviously we didn't like moving around as much as we did, but C Battery was one of the three that seemed like it moved more than the other ones did. We did what you called hip shoots. There was four guns in the battery. They originally started with four 8-inch howitzers, and I think they changed two of the tubes to 175 millimeter for extended range. A hip shoot is when two of the guns, usually the 8-inch, would be called out for a short mission that we couldn't reach from the firing or from the landing zone that we were like based at. So the guys didn't like, you had to pack up everything, and get on this gun and get back on the road again where you were more vulnerable to the enemy. Go into a jungle or a different area. Hurry up and set up the guns, and then do your fire mission. And when that was done, then you went back to the landing zone, which was considered your base camp. So it was tough.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I don't think that I don't believe that the morale was bad or low.
Mm-hmm. What was the makeup of the battery? How many men? Charlie Battery.
From most of the I sent to the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis for the morning rosters. It appears that most of the I don't know exactly what the total strength should have been,
mm-hmm.
but it looks like it averages between 115 and 120 men.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, and I wasn't in a gun section. I was in the motor pool.
Mm-hmm.
I believe a gun section had somewhere between 8 and 12 individuals, and I think they kind of like rotated sort of like 12-hour shifts.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the people were in fire direction control. The motor pool, I believe in the motor pool we had about six mechanics. Each section well, some of the sections had clerks. We had a clerk in our section. Each battery, each gun section had a section chief, which was usually an E6, an E5 or an E6 sergeant, some ammo people, ammo drivers, driving five-ton trucks full of these big projectiles that they would get from either service battery or from other areas. You had ration truck ration trucks that would bring in food when you were in an area that could be reached by road. Water trucks to bring in potable water. A couple of FDC track vehicle, or one FDC track vehicle that had the radio equipment in it for when we were on convoy. Three or four what they called M548 track vehicles, which was basically a track with a big open area that you could load in shells with. Each gun section had one of those so that they could move their, if you did have to go on a hip shoot, you could load shells in those and move those with the on the hip shoot. You had probably... I'd say maybe five-ton trucks, four or five two-and-a-half-ton trucks, some drivers for those. Some of the guys did multiple jobs. When they weren't doing a fire mission, they'd drive a truck. Everybody rotated pulling KP. You had the mess section, which was run by a higher-up sergeant. Then I believe you had like a Spec 5 in there or something like that, and then a few other, maybe three or four other cooks, some of which would maybe bake during the evening hours so that you'd have food in the morning. And then you had a first sergeant that he was the top NCO. Mm-hmm. You had a captain. You had an executive officer, either a first or second lieutenant. That's about it.
Okay. Well, of all those vehicles, did you primarily only work on the 8-inch and the 175 millimeters, or did you work on all of them?
I worked on all of them. Actually, I probably worked on more wheel vehicles than I did on the track vehicles, because most of the problems that we had with the track vehicles involved hydraulics. There was a lot of hydraulic lines on the howitzers, and from the extreme pressures from shooting those, constantly had leaks and stuff like that. So you had what you called an artillery mechanic or a turret mechanic. That would work on those when he wasn't available, or if he was working on another gun and a different gun needed to be worked on in that respect, then I would be asked to go out there and see if I could repair the job.
Okay. And how much did you work or interact with the crews, the gun crews?
Usually, the Army has like a system of you do quarterly and yearly maintenance. If we were at a low period, you might go out on a gun and go through a list of checking things and mark it as either green, yellow, or red, which meant red meant no, you can't use the gun, absolutely can't use it because we have a problem. Yellow would mean this problem could cause some problems, and we want you to watch them. Green would be okay, maybe you got a problem, but there's just no problem using the gun. When I went out and did that to a gun, I would have a fellow from the gun section with me to help me. If we had to pull an engine, you would have either what they call the cherry picker, which was a like a crane on a on a truck, or you had an M88 tracked tank retriever, which had a big boom on it, and then you would have to pull the engine and transmission out of it. Then you would have a few other guys from the section helping you. Not just one. They might, the sergeant might, section chief might assign two or three guys to help you.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, you had the motor pool. I being in the motor pool had the interaction with those gun sections.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you finish one job, you go to another section, you talk to those guys in that respect, and then you'd have interaction with everybody if you were in the mess hall. Or in that respect.
Okay. So when you weren't working and you were just hanging around with each other, there was a lot of interaction, intermingling. You weren't like motor pool people didn't necessarily just hang out with each other, or did
most? I would say most of the times the guys hung in their groups.
Okay.
You know, most of the time us motor pool guys. Would hang out in one area or something like that. You pulled guard duty. Usually, the motor pool usually had one outpost, and then we would rotate pulling guard duty. But you always had three guys in that outpost. Sometimes you might get an ammo driver. They might be assigned into your motor pool area for pulling guard duty. So you'd pull an 8-hour shift.
Mm-hmm.
With a man from a different section.
Okay. And how about racially? Was it during your downtime in particular? Was it self-segregating or?
When I was there, I didn't really notice like the African Americans getting together like in a group like some may have seen before. I think we were pretty interactive in that respect. I heard from other members of our association now that later on, I was there only until April of '69. I heard that later on in late '69 and into '70 that they had some racial problems. It's hearsay though, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know.
Okay. What about, before you left for Vietnam and then after you got to Vietnam, how much about the anti-war movement had you heard about?
Before I left for Vietnam, it was like nothing. I wasn't aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
I seen a little on TV. What was going on right before I left in Milwaukee area was the racial riots.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were more concerned with that than what was going on in Vietnam right at that particular time, because our governor called out the guard, and we had military trucks running up and down the street that I lived on.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't involved in the anti-war movement actually either before or after I got out of the service.
Mm-hmm. Well, not so much active. I was just curious what you heard about.
Yeah, or even aware of it. As a matter of fact, even in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Once in a while, a friend, my next door neighbor buddy, would send a copy of the Milwaukee Journal.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really see a whole lot in there. Once in a while, we got Stars and Stripes
mm-hmm.
over there.
Mm-hmm.
You'd pick up a little bit, but I think it was, who knows? It was may have been edited out. My buddy also sent me a small, not a cassette, but a small reel-to-reel tapes of radio stations once in a while that I could play on a recorder. Didn't hear a lot then. And the only real rumors that I remember in the unit themselves was. Some talk about Nixon, but not a whole lot of actual direct anti-war movement information.
Okay. Now, just before you arrived in Vietnam, was the Tet Offensive of 1968. When you got there, Did people in your unit, did guys in your unit talk about Tet, tell stories about what happened?
Well, actually, when I got there, mm-hmm. No, that Tet happened. That was January 31st of 68.
Mm-hmm.
I got there in April 5th.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember a whole lot of people talking about Tet from C Battery, although I know that I know now that there was some pretty hot landing. It was a pretty hot landing zone where C Battery was at the time. At that time, they were at LZ English.
Okay.
But no, they didn't mention too much about that. There was another. Supposedly, there was supposed to be another Tet after that,
mm-hmm.
in 69. I don't remember what exactly the dates were, but I do remember that when I was in the Upper Highlands is where I seen a lot of the action, and I'm assuming that I was part of that.
Okay. Now, was there, when you were working in C Battery, were there many shortages of certain pieces of equipment or items that you needed but just couldn't seem to put your hands on or just didn't have a lot of?
In the motor pool area, we had a large, it was a 2.5-ton truck that actually was an office.
Mm-hmm.
It had a couple of counters in it on each side as you walked into the back door, which was in the center. You'd walk up some steps and in there. And then we would have smaller parts in there, and below the counters and above the counters were drawers where you would keep parts, and the clerk would have them on a roster. And then we would also have a trailer that we pulled behind that with larger parts. You would run into, what they would do is they would allocate what parts that you should have on hand. And this would be something very similar to my job as a machinist at Outboard Marine Corporation. If I needed a certain part for my machine, and I went to the tool crib and I asked for it, well, no, those are on order. Well, we're only allocated one, and so-and-so got this the other day. So that's what we ran into. And what we would do in that respect is, one of the jobs that I learned from our old motor sergeant was our captain used to give us these sundry packages. Sundry packages are a cardboard box that's about 2 feet square, and in there there are a carton of cigarettes, candy bars, other candy, soap, shaving equipment, that type of thing. Those sundry packages were for people who were out in the sticks that weren't at a landing zone, that didn't have access to those items and weren't able to get those items. What we did is we took a couple boxes of those and would go to the local whorehouse. We would sell those boxes to the mama or, you know, whatever that was running the place for $100 a piece. We would then go into the battalion maintenance and pay off the first sergeant that was running that place to buy a new or to get a new starter rather than a rebuilt starter. And then we would go back to the unit, and we would have the part that we needed.
You would have to pay off an American to
yeah.
receive a piece of equipment?
Right.
Did anybody think to report this?
Well, you know, when you're like 20 years old and you got a whole lot of people that have been there in the service longer than you are, you just kind of figure, I'm here for a year, I'm going to go along with the program, this is what's been done in the past, I'm not going to make any waves. I'm going to do what needs to be done. We got the new starter, our equipment is running, we're there if they need them. I don't know if I thought of it at the time or not. I certainly didn't mention it to anybody.
Have you talked to other people? And you're active in the 15th Field Artillery Association. Have you talked about this type of issue with other members of the association since that was formed? Your activities.
When we're at reunions, or I have a pretty close buddy of mine that I went to high school that was in the same unit but mm-hmm. a little bit before, we'll discuss that. The things that are, you know, different things that went on.
Do you know if they've experienced similar instances? Or?
No. Nobody has told me that they did that.
Okay.
Or has agreed to it, or
wow.
you know, whatever.
Okay. Was this an isolated incident, or did this happen, you know, on a number of occasions?
Well, I did that when I was in the area of Ben K and On K at Landing Zone LZ Diamondhead.
Mm-hmm.
I did it once when we were in the Pleiku area, and after that, I think we. I think we were getting the parts that we needed or whatever. I don't remember doing that in the second half of my tour.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember that in that first half year though that we weren't getting what we needed. We were moving around a lot. I know that some of our tracks. Hit landmines, that type of thing, and we were replacing parts.
Mm-hmm.
We lost the motor sergeant was transferred out. We were operating without a motor sergeant for a while, just basically doing what we needed to do to get along.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you know if your CO was aware of this type of stuff?
I have a feeling that he was because. It was my understanding that the motor sergeant was given those boxes from the commander.
Mm-hmm. To trade, to take to the prostitutes, to trade for the money to get the parts.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Okay. Well, was there ever, was that your only interaction with Vietnamese people? Going to the, to the whorehouses to trade your sundry boxes for cash? Were there other exchanges?
Well, we had just about wherever we went, if there was South Vietnamese people around that wanted to make some money,
mm-hmm.
we could have them fill sandbags for us. Some of them helped with the mess hall area.
Mm-hmm.
We sent our when we were in an area that had somebody that would wash our uniforms, they would wash them and they would starch them with something that smelled like fish.
Mm-hmm.
When you got the uniform back, it was clean, it was pressed,
mm-hmm.
but as soon as you started to sweat, you smelled like fish. Some at certain locations at LZ Blackhawk, we had. Some gals that would come in and clean the hooches for us once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I think at LC Oasis we had a Vietnamese barber.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all of the interaction that I actually had. Usually I think they must have gotten somebody else to run parts and that type of thing,
mm-hmm.
because my second half of the tour, I didn't do that too much. Have too much interaction with the Vietnamese people themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned earlier hip shoots, and I was curious when a section of the battery would go out for a hip shoot. Would they typically go out alone? Would they have, an officer with them, a fire direction control vehicle with them, that kind of stuff? How did that typically work?
It basically would depend on where on what location that you were going to.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, right before I left to go home, We were doing a hip shoot at another landing zone, LZ Action, where there was already a 105 or a 155 towed unit set up. Mm-hmm. So they would have the FDC, the fire direction control equipment, already at the landing zone. So that in that case, you wouldn't need to take that vehicle with. Mm-hmm. Not being in the gun battery or gun section myself, I don't know that much about the fire direction control and the forward observers and calling in these directions to bring in the first shell and then how to adjust that type of thing. But I would assume that if a couple of guns went out, that the FDC vehicle was with us.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And probably a 2.5-ton truck with some C rations. You'd have to take an M548 out there with mm-hmm. two of those with shells in them.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on how long you were at that location, you'd have to run ammo out to them, mm-hmm. either by truck or you'd have to bring it in by a helicopter.
Okay. Now, from a, I'm not sure how familiar or how much information you have in this regard, but from a firing standpoint, in terms of distance and accuracy, to your knowledge, which weapon was better, an 8-inch or a 175?
It's my understanding now that I've been involved in this association that the 8-inch was much more accurate than the 175.
Okay.
The 8-inch didn't shoot as far, but it was more accurate.
Okay.
And the distances vary from what one person says to another. Mm-hmm. Some of them say that they shot... that the 175 shot 126 miles, and that the 8-inch shot 20 miles. Some people say that it might be a 20% less than that.
Okay.
And as far as accurate, I heard that an 8-inch, if the obviously the first shell needs to be called in by a forward observer,
right.
And the whole country was laid out in grids. The first shell would land. After that, they could bring it into an area. The first shell would land into an area about the size of a football field, and then they could adjust after that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in terms of maintenance, which weapon was easier to maintain and have fewer mean times between failures, stuff like that?
I can't determine between the 175s and the 8-inch, because basically the only difference in those would be the tube. Everything else would be the same.
Oh, okay.
On them.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we had one gun which was the gun sections would always put a name on the tube. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Candy 2 was the one. Most of the pictures that I have of me performing maintenance is on Candy 2.
Mm-hmm.
That gun was, we were always having problems with it, one thing or another. I think basically it led to electrical wiring problems, which weren't corrected, during this long time that we were working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Also ran into problems with the way that the fuel tank was on those. The fuel tank was an area, large area inside the gun area that was part of the hull.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ran over a road mine, and the bottom was warped from an explosion or something, and it had cracks in it, you might have leaking. I heard that later on they were considering putting rubber bags in there as a way to stop that. Problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they did or not. And the rest of the problems were always with the rear spade. You had a large rear spade that you dug into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That took the shock of that big gun. That's the
mm-hmm.
that's what took the main shock. So you were constantly re-welding portions of the spade.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem was they had a auto loader on them.
Mm-hmm.
These projectiles, depending on which one went from 160 to 200 pounds, you had a large tube with a hook on it. The two guys would grab that tube, or sometimes one, move that shell to this auto loader at the ground level. The auto loader would hydraulically lift the projectile onto a slide. It would then move in line with the back end of the tube. The guys would have the breech block open, and then this auto loader would push the shell in, and then they would put the ammunition or the powder behind that. So that auto loader was one of the problems that was because of the fact that it was used a lot. Sometimes those didn't work, and you'd have to have either you could repair them, or you would have to load the howitzer without the use of that.
And I'm sorry, you said that this gun in particular where you had problems with, was this an 8-inch or a 175?
That was an 8-inch.
That was an 8-inch. Okay. From what you remember, was that typical or atypical, that the 8-inchers had more problems than the
I couldn't say.
Okay.
I couldn't say. I just remember that one particular gun.
Mm-hmm.
I know the I found the driver of that gun.
Mm-hmm.
He told me that the gun was replaced while he was still in country. He was there, I think maybe 6 months longer than I was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in terms of maintenance scheduling, would most of these vehicles and guns be rotated out at certain intervals for major overhauls and repairs? You know, just on a regular basis.
I don't remember that. As far as being on a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
I think it was they were sent out as needed.
Okay.
If there was battalion maintenance units in Vietnam. I remember one in Pleiku area. I don't remember the name of the number of the unit. We've got some photographs on the website which shows a gun inside of it. It's like a large metal building, and they might take that gun in there to put in a new engine or put in a new transmission.
Mm-hmm.
When we didn't do it out in the field, because we had done that type of work in the field too. I meant at a fairly secure landing zone.
Okay. All right. Well, when you were back in, say, a firebase-type situation, did your areas get hit very often with enemy mortars and rockets?
We were the first portion of my tour up to late June or early July of 68. I didn't experience too much of that. When we first got on Artillery Hill, the first night. We were there. We had incoming mortars. We would experience that once in a while. We were there.
Mm-hmm.
We moved into. From there, we went on. We went to several other locations. Occasionally, we would get hit with mortar, usually mortar or rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved into LZ Oasis. LZ Oasis is where we were constantly being hit with mortars. We had the group it was, but the enemy would come in and would throw satchel charges in the outposts where they would actually physically try to come into the landing zone.
Mm-hmm.
And at that was the hottest location that I was at. And before I went home, I was at LZ Blackhawk. There we took mortar and rocket fire. And while I was at Blackhawk, we did the hip shoot to LZ Action in between the Mangyang and the Anke Pass. And there we also took mortar,
mm-hmm.
incoming mortar.
Did you lose many people from your battery?
From our battery. I'm not sure how many are from our battery, but we have, we know that there are, I believe, 19 on our unit wall that we found, that we know for sure.
From when you served?
This was our first casualty was February 2nd, 1968, in C Battery, in the battery mm-hmm. that I was in, but I wasn't there yet.
Mm-hmm.
That was right during TET.
Okay.
Although it was not a hostile fire, it was a racial problem.
Okay.
So that was basically a murder.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the rest. One was, I think, a finance guy that was killed in convoy. We had a couple people, other people killed in convoy.
Mm-hmm.
We had four people that went down in a helicopter. We had one man that was blown up carrying a powder
mm-hmm.
for the gun.
Mm-hmm.
Spark or something hit it. He was disintegrated. We had a suicide. We've had a few suicides after.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you exactly offhand.
But while you were there for that year, do you know how many were lost to enemy fire?
I've got the dates, but I'd have to look that up.
Did you know anybody personally?
No.
Okay. Okay, good enough. Now, did your unit use helicopters for recovery purposes at all?
Or
transportation?
Well, the one helicopter that went down, that had some high-ranking people in it, and I believe that they were moving from one battery to the next,
mm-hmm.
Probably checking things or whatever, and we're not sure if it went down because of enemy fire or if it was a mechanical problem. So we did have helicopters. We had these big Chinook helicopters. I don't believe that they were actually our unit, but they were either attached to our unit or they were used to supply
mm-hmm.
Ammunition and parts that our motor pool would use,
mm-hmm.
and they would bring those parts and ammunition into our landing zones.
Okay. Now, do you know how much an 8-inch or a 175-millimeter self-propelled tracked vehicle weighed?
No, that would probably be at our website.
Okay.
They're heavy, big.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if they were ever sling-loaded?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I never seen one of ours sling-loaded.
Mm-hmm.
When we had to move, if we moved one of our vehicles without using the you know, its own power,
mm-hmm.
they were moved on what they call 10-ton lowboy trucks.
Okay. Now, how much infantry support did your battery have? You know, and how much protection did infantry provide to you then?
When we were at LZ Diamond Head, the first part of my tour, we set up with the Republic of Korean First Capital Tiger Group. That was an infantry group. They helped guard our outposts, our posts. When we went to LZ Jenny and LZ Linda, we pulled guard duty with them to help secure the area. When we went up into the Upper Highlands in the Pleiku area and along the Cambodian border, we were basically supporting the 4th Infantry Division up there, some special forces, in which case... some of those units were used the same landing zone, LZ Oasis. We had first of the 69th Armor that had a tank division, or not a division, but a tank unit up there that helped pull the perimeter. We had 4th of the 60th Air Defense Artillery Dusters, which were like big four-barrel 40-millimeter guns. On a track vehicle, we had those dug in just about everywhere we went, to one on each side of the perimeter, to help perimeter guard. Those were very impressive guns to have on a perimeter to help pull you know, if the enemy was going to be coming in. That's basically it. Besides our own group and pulling our perimeter guard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned those were air defense artillery quad 40s that were trained into an area to actually provide anti-personnel cover.
I think that's their main purpose. I don't believe that those were actually ever used for anti-aircraft weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They were mostly put on the pulling for perimeter guard. That's the only place I've ever seen them used.
Well, now you yourself, what did you carry for your personal weapon?
We were given an M16 in service battery when we first came in country. That was the first time that I held one. I was trained with the M14 rifle, and that's what I had in basic training. That's what I was used. That's what was used for qualifying.
Mm-hmm.
Never really given any instructions on how to tear it down or anything. I kind of had to learn that from the other guys that were there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
After we were there in somewhere along the line, I don't know if it was in LZ Diamond Head or if when we moved up into the Upper Highlands, they pulled our M16s from us and gave them to the infantry. Some of the infantry, I think they were the Arvin units, and gave us and reissued us M14s.
Okay.
Which I like better than the M16, and then I also purchased locally. I purchased a what they call a grease gun.
Okay.
That was a it looks like a grease gun. It's got a tube that you screw into the front.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a slide you can pull out in the back to push up against your shoulder. Shoots a 45 caliber round that was available for the service revolvers that the officers used.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great gun to carry when I was on the road going for parts or kind of like an in close gun.
Mm-hmm. And you bought that?
Right, I bought that from another vet that was leaving country, which is the same thing that I did. When I left country, I sold it to someone else.
Do you remember how much you paid?
$50.
Okay.
It had two straight chambers that held 20 rounds apiece.
Mm-hmm.
Came with two clips.
Mm-hmm.
Loaded both clips, so you had 40 rounds, and taped the two together back up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd have 40 rounds available to you right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a slower automatic, so it wouldn't. As compared to the M16,
mm-hmm.
if you had that on fully automatic and pull the trigger, I don't know what that held, how many rounds, but it was like they were gone in an instant.
Mm-hmm. And was this actually a military weapon that was just?
Yeah, it's. I looked it up. I can't remember the name, but I did look it up on the internet,
mm-hmm.
and it was used. I think it was used in towards the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that's the gun that Sergeant Saunders used to use on combat, because
mm-hmm.
I used to make jokes about it when I was overseas.
Okay. But the one that you bought, wasn't that probably owned by the military?
I would assume it was owned by the military at one time or another. I don't know how it came into country
mm-hmm.
or how it got in that area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that it was issued by the United States to somebody there in Vietnam.
Okay.
Either somebody sent for it, or it was a weapon that was in country that was purchased from locals or something.
Mm. Okay. Let's see. And did you, at what times did you actually have to fire either the M16, the 14, or your grease gun to defend yourself or to in a security or a combat environment?
The only time that I actually fired a weapon at the enemy was when I was on guard duty.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, it was all what they had, what they called a mad minute, which was before sundown, when anybody that wanted to check their their equipment to fire it.
Mm-hmm.
You could go to the outpost, as you know, to the perimeter of the LZ, and fire out into, you know, away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, it was using a, I believe it was called an M60 machine gun that used same type round that the M14 did,
mm-hmm.
Fully automatic submachine gun.
Mm-hmm.
On a turret, and that was used during each outpost, guard outpost had one of those set up. It was like a Quonset hut that was dug down into the ground and then sandbagged, and they took a torch and cut out a long slot so that you had a span of the area in front of you. And when we were at LZ Oasis, when we had the enemy coming through the to the wire, we basically just kept loading it and firing it, just to keep rounds out.
Was that one of the times where you personally had to fire your own?
That was the only time.
That was the only time you had to fire your own?
That was the only time that I fired a weapon at an enemy.
Okay. How did you feel?
Scared. I just wanted to keep on putting bullets out.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to give anybody a chance to get closer.
Mm-hmm.
We had you could hear the rounds. You could hear them going through the air,
mm-hmm.
when they passed you.
Mm-hmm. How far away was the enemy?
Two to three hundred yards.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these Viet Cong or North Vietnamese Army? Pavin?
Couldn't tell. It was. I wouldn't. I wouldn't know. It was. They had hats.
Mm-hmm. Like the pith helmets, or.
Yeah.
Okay.
The guys that came through though. Came through the wire. Mm-hmm. They didn't have uniform. They had their legs and arms wrapped up with sheets,
mm-hmm.
linen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And no shirt,
mm-hmm.
no hat.
Okay. When you were being supported by the Republic of Korea, soldiers, and they were providing your infantry support, defense, whatever. How much had you heard about the Korean forces, and what did you hear about them in terms of their reputation while you were there?
Tough guys, didn't take any crap from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them at LZ Jenny. I seen them shoot at kids that were coming into the dump looking for food to eat. I seen a Korean officer hit a guy on top of the head at a military police outpost at the top of the head with a machete.
Mm-hmm.
I seen their captain at LZ Linda. I had three guys in the front leaning rest position. You know what that is for doing push-ups, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In that position with a horse whip, whipping his soldiers on the back with a horse whip.
Mm-hmm.
One of these short whips about 3 feet long, and it had real fine strings on the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And did you have a preference in terms of infantry support, that is, people who were providing your perimeter with security?
I guess I didn't at the time. I imagine that I figured any help,
mm-hmm.
Whatever, put more men out on the perimeter, whatever it takes to, so that the enemy doesn't come in. The language barrier with the Koreans was obviously a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We only used those in Sea Battery though when we were in in towards the coast area. And then after that, basically we pulled our own perimeter guard, and I would have rather had somebody there that I know.
And were there any particular incidents that you recall or activities that you recall that you want to discuss?
Well, the my recollection of the of the times that stay in my mind are at up in the Upper Highlands area when the enemy was trying to overrun LZ Oasis. They threw satchel charges into bunkers and killed some of our people. I recall seeing a body bag near the mess hall that was one of our it was an American soldier. I had seen plenty of the enemy that we blew apart that were trying to come in that looked like they went through a meat grinder, but it's a little bit different when you see your own people in a body bag. And I was wounded in a convoy. That incident was the biggest event that I still live with.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and talk about that?
Well, we were in LZ Oasis. It was on I believe the 15th of November, the day before I was wounded. The captain had asked for some of the people from maintenance to take two M48 track vehicles into the Duck Co area near the Cambodian border, where a 105 or 155 towed artillery unit was overrun while working with, I think it was 5th Special Forces. And they needed vehicles up there to pull the guns out of the jungle area or overgrowth area. And we took I think there was four of us, two in each M548, and we drove down the highway 19 East to an area that they said, well, just keep going down this road and you'll see the area. It's real obvious. And then we turned off the road and went through a heavily wooded or jungle area. It was basically like walls up to the area where you could just get the vehicle through. You couldn't see maybe 5 feet into the brush. And we drove down that road, and then you came to the opening of the landing zone, and you could see that the area was really blown apart. And once we got in there, there was a few people in there, and the guns had already been pulled out using 5-ton trucks. So it was getting late, and we were asked if we would like to stay with the 5th Special Forces at a Montagard unit or Montagard village near the border. And we discussed that between those guys, and we figured we'd be safer if we drove back to the LZ Oasis. And that's what we did. We on the way there, we burned up one vehicle. We had to tow it back into the landing zone. We got there at dusk, and right away the captain came up to us and said, "Pack up. We're leaving. We're going right back to where you were tomorrow." So that's what we spent the rest of the night getting ready. The whole battery kept getting ready, and we left somewhere around 1:30 or so p.m. And around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or shortly there before, our FDC unit stopped running, which is a track vehicle, looks like an MPC personnel carrier. And being in maintenance, well, we were always at the end of the convoy. pulled up behind the vehicle, asked them what was wrong. The vehicle just stopped. I opened the engine compartment and seen that the fan belt for the generator had came off. The belt was still in one piece. I put the belt back on where it was supposed to be, and we were using an ammo truck, a 5-ton ammo truck, and I figured, well, we'll put this back on, turn down the ignition, and we'll see if we can push it to start it. And I was, my buddy John Rodriguez was driving. We had a first lieutenant in the passenger and one other guy in the center and a few guys up on top in the truck. And I stood on the outside by the driver on the running board, and I said, and I kind of motioned him. I said, okay, bring it up a little bit closer until the front bumper met the back of the vehicle and it was stopped. And I said, okay, let's start pushing it. And we started pushing it, and we figured that there was a remote detonated landmine in the road that the enemy triggered and blew the hell out of the two vehicles. And me being on the running board, I ended up being blown way up in the air and then off and landed on the road. My ears were ringing. I had mud packed in my eyes. I landed on my knees and my elbows, and I guess I was just in shock. Didn't realize what happened. I had a buddy, Robert Anino, that came to help me. He pulled me off to the side of the road, washed my eyes out with water, brought me my glasses, brought me my weapon, and stayed with me until the chopper, medevac chopper, came. In the meantime, we had a gunship company that was located at LZ Oasis that were, I believe they must have been already in the air following the convoy. And before the medevacs came in, they had the gunships were spraying the areas along the tree lines. Basically stayed down until they cleared the area, and then the medevac choppers were brought in, and I was medevaced out.
Okay. How long was your convalescence?
Well, from there I went to like a MASH unit someplace, and then was transferred to Pleiku. Mm-hmm. From Pleiku I was taken down to Cameron Bay, and I stayed in Cameron Bay, six convalescent center, until mid to late January of
69. Okay. While you're there at Cameron, do you remember there being any particular services available to you to help, spend your time there more productively, library facilities, that kind of stuff?
I know that they had a big canister in the ward that I was in that were people from the United States that were writing soldiers. So, if you wanted to write somebody, you could pick out a letter and then write. I think they had movies set up on the beach. Once in a while they had some type of a club there, but I don't know if it was an officers club or whatever, but I didn't go to it. They set me up in a room with a captain and a first sarge. We kind of helped each other clean wounds and stuff like that. And those guys would bring me back a cocktail once in a while when they went over to this place. Mm-hmm. I think Ann Margaret was there with Bob Hope. They asked me if I wanted to go to that, but I just it meant sitting in the sun for several hours waiting, and I didn't wasn't up to it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all I know as far as services there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in general, were you getting newspapers, like the Stars and Stripes, and did you have radios, that is, portable radios that you could listen to music on and stuff like that throughout your time in Vietnam?
Somewhere along the line, we didn't all have that all the time. Somewhere along the line, I think I must have went to the Air Force base in Pleiku and purchased a small. It was a small, like 3-inch reel-to-reel tape recorder, and it had a radio built into it. I think. I don't remember listening to a lot of radio, but I did have my buddy send tapes. You know, he would record the local WOKY station here from Milwaukee, and then I'd play that over there.
Okay. Did you have access to newspapers and magazines?
I don't remember reading too much of anything as far as Stars and Stripes. I don't remember seeing a Stars and Stripes maybe once or twice while I was over there. Hmm. A couple of newspapers that were sent to me from home,
mm-hmm.
and that's about it.
How about letters? Did you correspond much with anybody back home?
Yeah, I whenever I could. That was one of the things that a lot of us guys relied on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as often as I could.
Okay. Now, do you remember listening to broadcasts from, you know, like Armed Forces Radio, that kind of stuff?
No.
Okay. And how about incidents involving animals, wildlife? A lot of snakes, bugs, cats, that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Monkeys?
When the first sergeant, myself, and this one other guy went in for his advance party when the Sea Battery was still out in Bamituit,
mm-hmm.
we spotted a large black cat that was moving around in the area at LZ Diamond Head. Basically, we just stayed in the hooch at night. We never seen it really during the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
But you could hear it on top of our hooch after we spotted it at dusk one evening.
Hmm.
George Catledge and I decided that we were going to bait it after it scared the hell out of me on one of the outposts in the evening, because it was like within 2 or 3 feet of me looking at me through this area that was cut through for our machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
That night that I seen it, I fell off of my stool and onto the fellow that was sleeping in the hooch there, or in the outpost with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we had told the captain about the fact that there was a big cat out there, and nobody believed us. So George decided that he was going to get some hamburger meat from the mess hall and bait it, and that's what we did. We put the meat on in the perimeter wire, and we never did get the large cat, but we shot a smaller cat, about the size of an ocelot. Other than that, up at and then I painted that cat army green, mm-hmm. olive drab, and we took it down to the dump and put it at the local dump. When we came back from parts, the Vietnamese locals had it on a spit. They were cooking it. The other thing was rats in the hooches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once in a while you'd get the, you know, you'd see them running around on the floor, or in the evening they might try to jump and end up hitting, you know, bumping you or something like that. Spiders were huge. Everything is huge over there as far as animals and spiders and things. And then they had a little, kind of like what looked like a chameleon, but bigger than what you'd see here in the States, and that made a strange sound, almost like a screaming sound,
mm-hmm.
and that thing would come out at night.
Was that the FU lizard?
Don't have a clue.
Okay.
I know it looked like a green chameleon, only larger.
Okay. Well, when it screamed, when it screeched, did it sound like it was saying something in particular?
No, I don't remember that.
Okay.
I remember it was an odd, though. It didn't. Whatever noise it was, it didn't sound like it should be coming from that little, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned the big cat, you said you killed the smaller cat, but the big cat you never did kill.
No.
When you say big, what do you mean by, about what size do you mean by big?
Oh, this thing had to be at least 80 to 100 pounds.
Okay.
The one that we shot was probably 40 to 60.
Okay. No tigers?
Never seen any
large
of those.
Okay. How about snakes?
No, don't remember seeing those either.
Okay.
We had a parrot.
A parrot?
I've got pictures of that up at our next to our motor pool hooch at LZ Diamond Head.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved, I think the parrot stayed.
Okay.
And then we had a couple of pets, small dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Grease, LZ, or yeah, we called him Grease. Motor sergeant stepped on his back coming out of the motor pool truck. So he had to kill the dog, and then I think later they got a, right after I left, they got AWOL, another little puppy.
Mm-hmm. How available was alcohol?
If I remember right, I think we had like a ration of 2 beers a day.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that if you were on the road, you could get it alongside the road. Other than you could get as much soda as you wanted, but I think the captain or commander kind of basically told you, you have your 2 beers a day and that's all you need here. And then obviously you needed ice, so you know when that was available, I've got pictures of us chopping up large pieces of ice.
Mm-hmm.
Try to get potable ice instead of unpotable ice.
Mm-hmm.
I think I remember buying a good bottle of scotch from the Koreans at LZ Diamond Head, and I remember buying a bottle of it must have been like Canadian whiskey at LZ Oasis.
Mm-hmm.
I got in trouble for that. Got a picture of me pouring out the rest of the bottle in the morning at the suggestion of the first sergeant.
Okay. And how would you, what about drug use?
I remember trying, somebody having some grass. I remember trying it once.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see what the idea is here. It didn't seem like it affected me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one of the guys from the ammo section that apparently did like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that he was smoking that stuff every time that he was on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really have anything against him. I suppose if I was an ammo driver, driving through these passes with all these big rounds of ammunition in the back of the truck, I may have been smoking the stuff every day too.
Mm-hmm.
He did smoke, I don't know if he lit one up or if he tried smoking one time on guard duty.
Mm-hmm.
But I told him, I said, no, I said, yeah, not here, not when you're pulling guard duty with me.
Mm-hmm. What was the commander's position on, and your senior NCO's positions on those things? Did you ever get told?
I don't remember. I don't remember a discussion in the first place. We had very few formations, where to get everybody together.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did, I didn't think it was a good idea let's everybody get in this one spot, to talk. I'm sure that they probably mentioned it, but
mm-hmm.
I don't remember an incident like that.
Okay. Was anybody ever prosecuted for using it, to your knowledge, in your unit?
Not that I know of.
Okay. And were there any major disciplinary or infractions, problems?
In C Battery, right before I get there, before I got there, there was that murder.
Mm-hmm. How about while you were there, though?
No, I don't. Other than getting busted, you know, for that was like a, that was happening all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some guy screwed up. You know, either he got, maybe got caught at the whorehouse, or he was sleeping on guard duty, or got into a fight with somebody. So they busted you for 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Now, while you were in country, did your perspective at all change, and did you develop maybe a better understanding about, you know, why the United States was in Vietnam?
I don't think it got better.
Okay.
I think my attitude was is that, you know, why bother? Why are we here? I don't understand this. You keep your gun with you, but don't keep it loaded. Don't be the first one to shoot. You know, wait till somebody shoots at you first.
Mm-hmm.
In an area where you know, in an area that's got a, you're in a civil war, where unless the enemy is in a uniform, you can't tell who's your enemy and who isn't.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think about the Vietnamese people, both the civilians and also the Arvin that you worked with or interacted with?
Well, I, in the first place, my experience with the South Vietnamese people, basically, if they were, you know, loading sandbags for us, or you know, the, possibly cleaning for us, or in a mess hall or whatever. Didn't really interact, didn't learn too much of the language. I was very leery of them at first. I thought it was disgusting that they would walk along the road and squat and relieve themselves. The country just reeked, and I'm assuming that it was because of the lack of waste, you know, waste systems. Their food, I thought, turned my stomach. When you'd go into their markets, it was it seemed like their the stuff that they were selling, food items and that, were I'm assuming that they weren't too sanitary. I didn't care for the odor of that, and I think that kind of reflected on my feelings towards them as a whole. And it got somewhat better before I left. But even in my dealings with Asian people here in the States, at work before I retired and that type of thing, I just kind of like didn't care to be around them.
Okay. And from what you could tell, what did you think about the way the United States was fighting this war?
Did you
feel at all like we were winning?
No, not at all. I do remember the fact that I think I was there during some type of ceasefire or talking about it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like we there was too many rules that we had to follow that didn't make sense to me. While you could see, for instance, forces from other countries that just didn't take any crap from anybody, and but for the Americans, you know, well, you're a guest here, you know, you have to do this, you have to do that. Don't keep around chambered, you know, because you know that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you wanted to do that because myself, I didn't trust any of them. I didn't know who was my enemy and who wasn't.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss about your in-country experiences?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, when you left, did you feel like you had accomplished anything?
Well, came home alive. I think that's a I think that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as you know, as far as my for myself, mm-hmm. obviously, I'm sure that there was some people out there that we supported that were glad that we were doing what we were doing as far as you know, giving them support. We did have several captains from infantry units coming in and praising us and you know, thanks for being there when we needed us, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And did when you got those kinds of that kind of feedback, would you get estimates of how many enemy you killed, things like that, or?
Oh, you mean numbers?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Okay.
I very little information on what was going on when I was there. I guess I wasn't in the right, didn't have the mm-hmm. right job for that. You know, if I would have been a clerk in the, you know, working for the captain or executive officer, or maybe an FDC or Condo or something like that, I might have been more in the know. But as a motor pool guy, I was up to my elbows in grease fixing mm-hmm. guns and never had an idea of, other than the name of the area that I was in, never seen a map.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was it like coming back to the U.S.? What do you remember about entering, you know, re-entering the U.S., you know, people at the airport, that kind of stuff?
I remember going down to Cameron Bay right before I left. I remember seeing they had a couple of 2.5-ton trucks pulled back-to-back, and they had a band playing there. Listened to them for a while, got on the jet. We stopped at either Guam or Okinawa, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure which it was, but there was like a ton of these B-52 giant bombers parked there. And while we were there, we had several hour layovers, and they said that don't bother going into town. These people don't like us here. And then we flew back to Washington State into the SeaTac airport. Supposedly, I guess everybody gets a steak dinner. I don't remember eating it. And then from there, you were issued Class A uniform, a couple of medals, other things you could stick on your uniform, and then you went home for a 30-day leave. I remember walking into Milwaukee Airport, feeling kind of proud, but people didn't exactly you know say well welcome back or you know anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Ma was great. You know, mm-hmm. she was really happy to see me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great being back. I started dating a gal that I started writing from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up marrying her. But some of the attitudes that some of the people had, I don't, like you hear people calling you baby killers or something like that. I didn't ever experience anything like that. Anybody saying that to me.
Mm-hmm.
But once I was home, I did realize what type of anti-war effort was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of ticked off that I missed Woodstock. I heard that would have been great to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Although now that I've seen it, I don't think I would have really enjoyed it as much as it sounded like it was supposed to be great.
Okay. But you didn't yourself encounter anti-war protesters or anything like that?
No, I don't. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I don't remember ever seeing anybody here in the Milwaukee area that was you know burning flags or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Things that I heard that were going on in the Chicago and Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm. What did you think as the war progressed and the Paris Peace Accords were signed in 73 and Saigon fell in 75?
Thinking that what a waste of lives and time being there was,
mm-hmm.
not really accomplishing anything,
mm-hmm.
and even though back then I felt that way. I still didn't really know that much about it as I do now, especially after kind of taking command of this artillery association and being sent information and videos and that type of thing, seeing the movies from public radio or public television, and getting more of an understanding of how the war started and evolved and went through to the end. To me, I think it was a big mistake.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that this is how your attitude towards the war and your understanding about what the war was about has changed the most?
I don't understand the question.
Well, you know, from the time you left to go to Vietnam to today, you know, how has your attitude about the war changed the most?
I guess it went from a feeling of I was one of the many that were drafted, and I was going to go over there and try like hell to get home, to get back, to one of what a useless idea it was to draft that many people and put us in that situation, run the war the way it was, and end up actually losing the war, and having the North Vietnamese come into the country and destroy more and more lives. It's a bad idea. It was a bad idea, and it gives my same opinion is every time I see us going back into another area of conflict.
So, what do you think is the major lesson, or what is a major lesson we should take away from our experiences in Vietnam as a nation? Is it to not do that kind of stuff, or?
Well, it seems like we're the world police department. You know, even though there was other countries involved in that, we're always the even though I guess we're the mightiest. You know, we our politicians are real quick to send us into areas into harm's way, and. I don't believe that some of the reasons that maybe their reasons are better explained to them, but I haven't been explained those reasons, and I think we should learn a lesson from the Vietnam War that we shouldn't make such hasty decisions as to putting our people in a situation of war.
You mentioned in the questionnaire, you bring up the issue of, and the questionnaire addresses the issue of Agent Orange. I was curious, I forgot to ask you while you were in country, we're talking about your in-country experiences. Was there ever any time where your unit used any of the defoliants, you know, in a backpack form or whatever to go out and just spray perimeter areas and that kind of stuff that you were aware of personally?
Okay, when I was in country, I was not aware of it.
Okay.
I was not aware of it at all.
Okay.
It was dealing with this artillery association is when I learned that that some of the units put these spray cans on their back and would go out and spray foliage when it started to overgrow, that type of thing.
Okay. Do you yourself feel like you've suffered any kind of debilitation because of Agent Orange or anything like that?
Yeah. When I first went into country, I had no skin problems. When I was there, I think maybe about four months or so, I started breaking out with acne. As soon as I came back into the States, I was still in the service. As soon as I came back, I went to a doctor's for the problem, and I've been on medication for it ever since.
Wow. You're still on medication for it?
Yes.
Wow. Now, how do you think the war affected you most personally? You know, what did you take away from that experience that's most important to you?
I've got a bad leg from that explosion.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to live with that all my life.
Mm-hmm.
That's a daily reminder.
Mm-hmm.
Was
there anything positive?
Well, I guess just about anything that I need to do here in the States is a lot easier than what I did over there.
Okay. If you could go back and do it over again, would you change anything?
I wouldn't be a mechanic. I would probably probably go to OCS or something like that for whatever unit was in the safest area.
Okay. All right. And is there anything else you'd like to discuss or add?
I don't think so. I think the only other thing would be possibly that finding the first reunion for the group that I'm in now.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, I think I found them around 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And through the last 5 or 6 years, dealing with talking to these people and dealing with the association gave me a little bit better understanding of what the war was all about.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big lapse in there that I probably thought about it, but didn't really discuss it that much.
Mm-hmm. Had you when you came back, you did not talk with many people about your experiences?
No, I never. I went to the Veterans Administration to apply for a disability for my leg, which they gave me a 20% disability. They gave me a hard time about that when I first went. I had to write the hospital administrator in order to have them do tests on me, which did show that I had nerve damage in the left leg. When I was at the Veterans Hospital, I seen a lot of guys without legs. Kind of led me to believe that I don't have it off. Have it as bad as I thought I did.
Mm-hmm.
I never, but at the same time, I ran into people in the waiting rooms there that seemed like they were abusing the system.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was my misunderstanding of what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I never joined a VFW post or anything like that. Because I guess I kind of feel like it was a bunch of people feeling sorry for themselves, talking about their bad experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm part of two associations, and I run another association, and I probably should have maybe gotten involved with one before.
Mm-hmm. Was it a difficult adjustment for you going back?
Coming back from Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. Did you kind of transition back into American life pretty easily, or?
I think it was pretty easy. I had already applied at Outboard Marine Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
I went back there. I think I had a month off or so. But when I came back into service from Vietnam, I had about 14 or 16 months still to do.
Mm-hmm.
While I was in Vietnam, my next door neighbor helped me through the Red Cross to get me a compassionate reassignment because I had orders to go to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Red Cross helped me to get a compassionate reassignment to the Fifth Army area, and I ended up at Fort Sheridan, Illinois, that I could drive every day and help my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then while I was in Fort Sheridan, I asked if there was anything open in the Milwaukee area, because I knew we had some reserve sites and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
One a first sergeant helped me out there, said that they needed a mechanic in the Milwaukee area at a Nike site, and so then I spent my time, the rest of my service, working at a place that was only about 2 miles from the house and living at home.
Wow.
So that turned out pretty nice for me.
Yeah.
I did apply as a civilian to run the motor pool in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to offer me the money that I wanted, so then I went back to Outboard Marine Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good thing that I did go back because the Nike sites started closing because of the Redstone missile coming into existence, so
oh,
they
yeah.
didn't need the Nike sites.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just went back to Outboard Marine Corporation, and I worked probably worked about a year before I went back to the VA and applied for educational benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up going to night school for about 13 years.
Okay.
And on the GI Bill for about 10 of those, and then
mm-hmm.
they'll still pay for books and tuition in certain instances.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How would you evaluate? How do you feel today about your service in Vietnam?
Well, it's probably the most unique thing that I've done in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything here in the States that's going to compare to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's about it.
Do you still feel proud?
Yeah. I wouldn't let anybody face me and tell me. That I was a bozo for being over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't exactly my idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud that I served.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else you'd like to say?
I think that's it.
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and end the interview. This will end the interview with Mr. David Holdorf. Thank you, sir.